Congratulations, Mathieu, on a nice paper. I think it raises some very... I didn't realise there were so many different forms of state intervention, and I should have known. But intrigued by your comment about taking the morality out of this, maybe it's sort of the latent Catholic in me that still thinks that, sin is a bad thing, but so is bankruptcy. And traditionally, bankruptcy has been seen as it's meant to be paid for. And if you look at most bankruptcies, you see fault. You see somebody screws up, it's grudged, and so on. So I guess my question is, what's wrong with it being a bad thing that we wish to discourage? It's a bit like death in this sense, you see. Death involves the recirculation of assets, or particles, and what have you. Bankruptcy does the same thing. It's an unpleasant process. So we minimize it, but we need it.
The fact that it is painful, I think the fact that it is painful is part of the process, is part of the reason why we fear it so much. You know, putting aside all of cronyism and issues, of course, that are really a big reason too, but one of the reasons why the public accepted so widely that that the banks needed to be bailed out in the United States, I believe, is because they believed that bankruptcy was going to hurt so much, you know. While in fact, the bankruptcy process doesn't hurt at least as much as that. Take for example the Lehman bankruptcy. There's been a high level of certainty in the Lehman bankruptcy. You know, from the very beginning, the estimation of the losses have been quite right. It's been very orderly, the coordination of the creditors. I really think that maybe if we didn't fear bankruptcy that much, maybe the public would be less inclined to accept bailouts.
Thank you. I'm very interested in one of the points you just made about Lehman, and I think your paper, it seems tantalizing, including the title, and provides some interesting insights and descriptions. But it would do a better service if, for example, it said, actually everybody thought the world was going to end when Lehman went into bankruptcy, and it didn't. So I think it's a very useful service to change. You've got to change the narrative on Lehman as it happens. Because the way it's actually been interpreted is, oh, that was also awful, that no other bank of that size or complexity can be allowed to fail. That's one side point. More specifically about your paper, that at the moment you provide a catalogue of different types of insider insolvency procedure or pre-insolvency bailout procedures without analysing what's good and what's bad. And I think you need to be clear about what your criteria are for things that help the market to clear and what things just prolong the agony, build up the bill, results in zombie institutions. For that reason, I'm actually very puzzled by your support for Chapter 11, which in other circumstances has actually been an instrument of perpetuating zombie firms, the US airline industry. And it's two kind. It keeps the management in place, for example, when often these are the people who've popped up in the first place. So I find that surprising. And I also find surprising that you don't like the FDIC, which actually is being used as a model elsewhere for ways to allow banks to fail. And the FDIC deals with hundreds of bank failures every year, and this is a wonderful thing. It's not just because it deals with them. It's because by making the procedure routine, it encourages new entrants. That's the point. The FDIC is a part of the renewal of the banking industry in the US, and this is where it is important. And it's being copied elsewhere. So, for example, in the UK, we have a recovery and resolution regime, partly modelled on the FDIC. The interesting question is how to move the places of work, resolution work, up the food chain. Because at the moment, there is a the too big to fail is a meaningful concept. There is a sort of, okay, well, banks no one's ever heard of in the Midwest, can fail, whatever. Banks we have heard of, which are national or international, but actually lots of new procedures have been put in place. which should make banks safe to fail, and all we need is a test of that. Things like the what's called living wills, which I think was described very briefly, which is not too important. Sorting out legal entities, not in the way that Lehman was with 2,000 subsidiaries, but a manageable number of business units which can actually be floated off to help. So you made one statement that I hope wrong, which is that all Spanish banks are insolvent. Well, for example, I would hope that, say, Santander and BBVA aren't, because they have, and we see an example of this at the moment. Santander is floating off a stake in its Mexican subsidiary. It's already raised several billion dollars by floating a stake in its Brazilian subsidiary, and that will help Santander to avoid bankruptcy, I hope, unless its domestic losses overwhelm even that. Even those internationally rich assets. So I think there's quite a bit of knowledge lacking here in terms of the way that the international world is trying to respond. And I'm not sure it's geared enough towards what types of bankruptcy and what types of procedure make banks safe to fail. And as you've said, and as everybody else has been saying, this is important, we have to have these failures. But just one final point, which is about deposit insurance. It seems to be a bit of an article of faith that deposit insurance in this company, that deposit insurance is a bad thing. I actually think it's fine. Bank runs are systemic issues that you need to keep aging. Depositors haven't been actually very good judges of the solvency of banks. And so if you count depositors out, There's still a huge number of constituents who should apply market discipline to banks, including shareholders, who should be wiped out when they support banks that take too much risk, including bondholders. And one of the elephant in the room here is bondholders and other creditors of banks, ex-depositors, the ex-retail depositors, who didn't apply market discipline and are still not being encouraged to apply market discipline because they're being made whole. So, reinstoring market discipline through write-downs of debt to banks, the amounts of banks owe to all sorts of creditors is an important thing. And you are going to get the market to life with things like innovative instruments, like contingent convertible capital, where it's pre-agreed that the debt will convert to equity, which is one of the interesting procedures that helps. We need some more of this. We need market pricing for this. And at the moment, it would be very expensive. Expensive because people are worried about banks as creditworthy institutions, so you charge them quite a lot of debt anyway. Plus a premium because you might suddenly swap your place in the queue, somewhere in the middle of the queue, as a bondholder, for a place at the back of the queue as a shareholder. So again, it's a sort of understanding of this great chain of being and queues in insolvency and how they, each of them, each level needs to impose some market discipline, ex deposit insurance. Okay, I'll stop there.
Lots of comments. Thank you. Lots of things. I'm not going to be able to answer to everything, but it's not so much a support of Chapter 11. Chapter 7 is fine also. It's a support of really the judicial process rather than the regulatory process handled by bureaucrats, really. You also mentioned living will. Living wills, for people that don't know what is it, is some sort of a prearranged bankruptcy, some sort of guide for regulators to wind. Still a prearranged process, and if you sort of interpret this as some sort of contract between whoever's going to resolve the bankruptcy and the firms, it's going to run into the problem that contracts are never complete, and especially economic crises are crises that are really unpredictable, are always very surprising. So I'm really skeptic about having a complete contract on banks that way. Regarding bank runs and do they turn into systemic risk, I'm afraid that's a kind of a myth that bank runs systematically and always turn into a run on the currency. Bank runs actually turning into a run on the currency have happened mostly twice, you know, 1893 and in the 1930s. Otherwise, bank runs have been kept greatly isolated. It's simply not true that bank runs are this great boogeyman. Regarding whether shareholders should be wiped out or should not be wiped out, it's not clearly spelled out in the paper, but the fact is that courts have a history of dealing with these problems. These are problems that are well known. Should the debtor or should the creditor take the losses? In law economics, we have a very large literature on that subject. So the idea that it should be always the debtor or always and completely the debtor, always completely the creditors, seems a bit, and that goes in support of my support of the judicial process for bank bankruptcies. I guess. But thank you for your comments. A lot of good stuff that I will use.
So I have a short remark and then a question for you. Short remark is about the argument too big to fail, how arbitrary this argument is. And as the argument goes, normally you take a country and then let the size of the bank grow up to a level, a threshold, where you say, well, now the bank is too big to fail because it could cause a systematic risk. This is as normally the argument goes. But in order to understand how arbitrary this argument is, you can just revert the perspective and say, take a bank and let the size of the country vary. So take the same bank, assume it is in France, in the US, in Switzerland, in Monaco, and of course you also see a threshold moving, and suddenly the bank, the same bank, is too big to fail, or is not at all too big. And since states or country borders are arbitrary in an economic perspective, have been determined by historical motives and so on, reasons, and you see how their argument just doesn't hold. My question is, what is your opinion regarding the so-called CoCo bonds, contingent convertible bonds, i.e. bonds that are converted into equity under given contingencies, which could be an automatic and progressive solution for capital dilution and injection of new capital, also providing some nice price mechanism in the market?
I think they're an exciting development, really, on regarding your last point on CoCo bonds and everything. There are debates and issues and problems regarding how there are they are triggered, when they are triggered, how many triggers do you need for them to be changed into. Is it going to be an option? Is it going to be a bond transforming into capital? Or in some countries' interpretation, it's simply left up to the regulator to arbitrarily transform debt into, at least that's what the debate seemed to be heading, to arbitrarily change some of the debt into capital. It's interesting, there's always the problem that in a bankruptcy, how these claims will be interpreted, will they be respected by the authority or by the judges. They're in exciting the development. We need to see more research on that and more experiences. Though one thing is that it doesn't necessarily seem obvious that bondholders necessarily are interested in becoming equity holders after a bank failure. You know, it's that's not necessarily obvious, but it is still an interesting development.
Other questions?
Hello, for me, my name is Christian Vasilov from Bulgaria. Quite a controversial question I would ask. Do you consider, as you already mentioned, that the Dodd-Frank Act in second best state of art? Of course, though we know that state intervention in free market is not welcome, do you think in second best state of art, as presently we are not having the banking system keeping with free market principles, is welcomed then, or should they be welcomed? As we all know, bureaucrats in the United States are really trying, some of them, to prevent these regulations to happen. But of course, if those were regulations in well-developed, free of intervention banking systems, they would probably be right. Nowadays, with the present situation, do you consider that this might change in a better position, the perspectives in front of the system, with the implementations of the Act, the piece of legislation that is really stopped right now, like with all those procedures that are preventing it from taking place in the US?
You're talking about which piece of legislation?
Dodd-Frank.
So, do I think it's going to be enacted? Do I think it's a...
And do you support measures in terms of regulations in the area that is, is to be implemented, not in best times, but in present situation where banking sector is moving out of free market principles, and it's really forgetting its main, the big banks forgetting their main goals to be like intermediators between the market and the ones who see finance, and it's like something like a partially state-run institution stuff.
That's a very good question. I'm not sure of an answer for that one. There are, not everything is bad in Dodd-Frank, of course, but there's a high level of uncertainty involved, and there's a lot of rough stuff that still needs to be fleshed out, many years after the bill was passed. So, do I think it's going to be all applied? No, probably not all, but. Are we going to go back to more market-oriented principles for resolving the bank? I'm skeptic about that. We're into this for the long run, and simply the fact that the Fed is being questioned now and people want to audit the Fed is really a great development, So there are reasons to be optimistic in the long run, I guess.
Mathieu, I missed to ask, have you a reaction to the comment of Victoria?
I really agree with everything Victoria said, especially about how the contextual depth needs to be there in the paper. I really like your formula that no bank is too small to be saved. I have only a positive reaction to them. I think you nailed it.
Other questions?
I'd say that in the flurry of regulation which is coming now, because the only response of the political elite now is to really sort of try and convince the population, convince the people, convince the industry that they're in control of it. So the regulatory machine is in full swing. And how long is the Dodd-Frank legislation? I think 8,000 pages? I forget. 30,000. Okay, right. So it's beyond belief. And not to speak of Basel III, and we probably have Basel IV, and this sort of I can only say it's a plethora of regulation. Clearly, it won't be. The probability of its failure increases with every page that's published. It can't be the way forward, because you're trying to legislate or regulate in fine detail a hugely complex piece of machinery, and as a general principle, you can't do this. You cannot do it. This is what Hayek tells us. It's a fatal conceit to think that we can regulate something as complex as the modern financial system, and it's going to go its own sweet way. Thank you.
There is a question.
I may have missed the basic point, but I wanted to agree with the fact that we are here witnessing an excess of regulation. On the contrary, I have the feeling that in this area we are dealing with typically a regulatory failure. Regulation means at the appropriate governance level. And we are dealing with banks which increasingly are becoming multinational or even global institutions. So I think what we need is to regulate, rather than having this multiplication of detailed and intrusive governmental expedients interfering with the market mechanism. We lack at the global level, where it should be, a much simpler and less bureaucratic way of establishing tools that make bank failure possible, and therefore now, in that sense, and then this is my question. My question was what's happening around the European Union. I personally believe that what we are trying to do in the European Union now, banking union, would be a major step forward, establishing some rules of the game at the European level. I don't agree with Victoria.
I'm interested.
The ambition there, and I don't know whether we will get there. But the ambition there is to do away with at least 17 and possibly 28 and establish a much simpler mechanism in terms of deposit insurance and in terms of supervision at a much higher level, therefore less intrusive, which would then leave the judicial mechanism to play ex post at the lower level. So in that sense, I think to have some regulation at the European level, and possibly that would become also a model to be applied, because it's not sufficient to be applied at the transatlantic level, because I think at that level that we are missing, that level that we become systemically relevant. So I wish if you had a comment.
Regarding the regulation of bank and the banks becoming international conglomerates, I think the question is what kind of governance will provide a framework for improving regulation and improving the way we watch over banks. And I think we should not neglect the fact that when there are different multiple jurisdictions competing to attract investment, competing to competing for investment money, that sort of fosters a dynamic for change in the good way. When we have some sort of homogenized top level regulator, the dynamics are different, and this sort of natural propensity to find good governance is sort of pushed out the door. So I think we should be careful with this kind of world regulation.
I agree. Oops.
There is another question.
I may have missed it, but, and in which case I apologize. But I think that what the main thing about treating differently is that you don't take the problem problems leading to bankruptcy as a way to think of banks in a different way. This point was raised yesterday, actually during the presentation of the Fodder's paper. But basically, all the functions of the banks could be done today by different, much smaller and leaner organizations, which, the banks will say, why should the bank remain as they are, with all these functions being performed by the bank, which can be performed by other organizations, much leaner and simpler, and also probably simpler to deal with in case of a failure of bankruptcy. It only, in a way, the Falker proposal goes in this direction, but there is much more on this direction to be done.
Do you have an answer from this one?
The last question?
No?
Micro, please. Push the button.
Mic doesn't work.
Okay. shall I repeat it? Did you hear that? So the title of your presentation calls for at least 50% of it to be dedicated and approached through political economy approaches. And because it's a heavily biased process where econometrics and economic analysis were not so hard to engage or more. So therefore, I think it's a super interesting and very relevant title, but it somehow sits too wide within the content you have presented. So this is a contextual mismatch somehow. The expectations are greater than you deliver. And it's a natural thing, although for me, the title is just like a good editor of a newspaper. The title is just great. But you would probably get less. My great concern within the current situation is that because it's we're dealing in a situation of emergency, there's a crisis, and some of the decisions that would be taken would not be subject to the standard procedures and processes. Therefore, in the rush to chase and adopt solution to quick fix the situation, we might see a monster happening. Because this banking union and this supervision over centralization, under normal circumstances, probably would have been faced with a mission impossible, given the time and ability of the governments to consider a response process on alternatives. Now we're pressed by time, and politicians, particularly political leaders, are subject to incredible pressure and the need to react within a limited amount of time. So, regretfully, I'm skeptic in this situation. I hope that at least the people that reason and can show the threats and the hazards with such an approach will speak out. And I think your presentation is a very good attempt in this direction. I hope the comments would add to it, to enrich it and make it more deep and versatile. I also, there's so many issues, but it's always the case. At the time, the battle is out there. It's the battle to win hearts and minds. And therefore, I strongly commend your article because it might lack in analytical depth, but who cares? It has to go out, and the battle has to be won. Therefore, I strongly encourage you to publish it
so that more people in this audience are able to get. And even if you don't give all the answers, people look for themselves, have a minute of thinking and then thought, and they would probably come to their best solution, because solutions are not unique. What is relevant for the United States is probably less relevant for Europe. It does not mean that, and even less relevant in Central and Eastern Europe. Because in my country, for example, the amount of the structure of the financial wealth and the deposits of the banks, people rely on banks to pull their financial wealth for incredibly high percentage and proportion. Therefore, if you talk to Bulgarian, okay, let's write up on this instead of deposit insurance schemes or things like that, it's very, very difficult. Whereas in a mature economy, when you talk to individuals, say, okay, in your capacity as stakeholder, you have absolutely no coverage. In your capacity as depositor, then you have all sort of safety nets, and this is a discrepancy. In my country, I'm afraid it's, the state is captured. It's not because the bankers are super clever. It is a sort of a mutual process. The politicians have an interest, and the bankers have an interest, so there's an act of mutual sort of protection of mutual interests. Okay, that's it.
That's true.
I agree with your comment. It should really be something closer to how banks are treated differently, or something like that. Both the title and the conclusion of the paper that I was reading just before the presentation really overstate what's being done in the paper. I agree with your comment, and thank you for you saying I should publish it.
Well, we stop. There is another one question? No.